Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Get a hold of your elected officials, weigh in, you know, look through the rule, make sure you've done your own homework.
Matt Derler, National Sorghum Producers, on a new climate smart rule.
What's the support for this and how much it can impact production agriculture go forward? How it help us tell the story? You know, the side benefit of this is the lower carbon ethanol we have, the lower carbon liquid motor fuels we have in today's vehicles. And I think there's a really compelling story to tell, not so much ethanol or gasoline, but how they fit. It's no longer button heads, but how do they fit together to make the most efficient use of the energy we have, leveraging the octane in the ethanol. And I think what we'll find is we've got some domestic options that are really compelling that aren't just EVs and can go a long ways, bridging the need for renewable fuels at the same time, providing opportunities in production agriculture here.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
As Senator Hovind said, I grew up in Arthur, North Dakota. This is a tiny town of about 400 people. We didn't even have paved streets when I grew up. It was all gravel. And it was 400 if you counted everybody that was also staying in the Good Samaritan home. That's how we got to 400.
Interior Secretary nominee, former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, before a Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee.
My father was a World War II Navy officer who served in the Pacific. My dad died when I was a freshman in high school, and my mom went back to work in higher education. I was blessed to learn from them about service, about leadership, about sacrifice, and certainly from both of them about a love of the outdoors. Growing up, I worked in our family's grain elevator. Every job I had all the way through junior high through the end of college was one that required showering at the end of the day, not the beginning of the day. And I even worked my way through undergrad at North Dakota State as a chimney sweep, which I loved that job because it was one that you could move up fast and always stay in the black. I thought it was the perfect career. After grad school, as John mentioned, I had an opportunity to go directly from undergrad to Stanford for an MBA. And the later I was working in Chicago, I saw my first Apple II computer. And that was the moment, literally, where I said, I need to get into the software business. And I'd inherited 160 acres of farm ground from my dad, and I literally bet the farm on that tiny software startup called Great Plains. With a dream and hardworking team members, we grew to a global public company with over 2,000 team members serving 140,000 businesses in over 100 countries around the world. I spent my entire professional career in the private sector until I was elected governor in 2016. And for the last 8 years, I've been blessed with the privilege of serving the citizens of the great state of North Dakota. My time as governor has been a valuable preparation for the opportunity and the privilege to potentially serve as the role of Secretary of Interior. As our state and my duties specifically as governor there put me in contact with many of the bureaus inside the department. In North Dakota, we share geography with five sovereign tribal nations. State and tribal relationships in North Dakota have sometimes been challenged, but the current partnership is historically strong because we prioritize tribal engagement through mutual respect, open communication, collaboration, and a sincere willingness to listen. I'm grateful for the many tribal nations, both in and outside North Dakota, for expressing their support for my nomination. As governor of North Dakota, I also serve as chairman of the North Dakota Land Board, which manages our state's land and minerals with the goal of yielding a return for a state endowment fund that significantly funds public education. I chaired the North Dakota Industrial Commission, which oversees 16 agencies that are related to a variety of things, including energy research, the state's geologic resources, energy production and transmission. The governor of North Dakota also serves as the chair of the State Water Commission, overseeing billions of dollars of water resources and projects. All of these are parallel responsibilities to Interior and often interacted with Interior agencies. In North Dakota, we created a prosperous economy by sustainably developing our natural resources, along with our respect for the land and the wildlife, and at the same time having among the cleanest air and the cleanest water in the country. During our tenure, North Dakota experienced among the lowest unemployment in the nation and the highest real GDP growth. Demographically, our state went from one of the oldest states to one of the youngest. We attracted record levels of talent and investment capital. I say this because our success was underpinned by the understanding that we live in a time of tremendous, tremendous abundance, and we can access that abundance as Americans by prioritizing innovation over regulation. If given the opportunity to serve as the Secretary of Interior, I'll bring those experiences and those lessons learned to the leadership of the tens of thousands of dedicated professionals within the Department of Interior.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It's an inset to ethanol.
Matt Derler is managing director of the Climate Smart Program with the National Sorghum Producers on what Climate Smart Ag is.
It's how do we draw farm practices connection to the carbon intensity of the fuel behind it. And, you know, and that looks like paying farmers for things like no-till and a crop rotation and the way we apply the nitrogen. But with anything that comes to the government program, there's a lot of data required. In 3 years of history on those farms, to understand the farm practices and how those are impacting the output from the field. For us as an organization, you know, we've struggled over time to get good quality data into national programs, but both in ethanol and other areas. So the opportunity to collect 1 million acres worth of data over 5 years gives us a really compelling way to tell the story of a production sorghum here in the heartland. And you look about the footprint of our grant, it's where 85% of the sorghum in the country is grown and where all the sorghum ethanol is produced. So a really good opportunity to do things with farmers and help them tell their stories, while at the same time building the data sets that we need to defend the industry and move it forward. Over the course of 5 years, you know, we'll have $50 million in producer payments that fold in and really make a difference for the farm in these tough economic times.
USDA out with an interim rule on crops used for biofuel feedstock.
As we pivot to thinking about the tax credits that go along with the Inflation Reduction Act, when 40B rules came out this spring, they were only tailored towards corn and soy, and it required a bundle. You had to be no-till, you had to plant a cover crop and use nitrogen inhibitors. And in reality, that didn't work for very much of the country, and obviously we as sorghum were completely left out of the rule. So in yesterday's rulemaking, really happy to see the acknowledgement that sorghum plays a vital role in these arid parts of the country in the biofuels production, and to know that there's not a one-size-fits-all practice or suite of practices for what makes sense in production agriculture. So the way the rules came out yesterday, you can incentivize tillage management, you know, be no-till or reduced till. You can have a cover crop, and the form and the timing of the nitrogen really matters. And obviously, there's a compounding effect if you put all those together, but allowing producers to be met where they are by monetizing this practice at a time, we think is really important to grow in these things as we go forward.
How does sorghum compare to corn in ethanol?
The starch structure of corn and sorghum is essentially the same. So they can grind them both in the same bin if they choose to. Several of the plants segregate those, basically fully fungible. Now, we do have a little bit more bound protein and starch matrix in sorghum, so we use a little different enzyme cocktail initially. But today, as plants look to separate the corn oil from the distiller's grains, pretty much the enzyme cocktail is the same amongst the plants too, so we have a lot of flexibility. When we look at corn and sorghum as feedstocks, there's a little more protein in the sorghum coming into the plant, a little more fat in the corn. So a different revenue opportunity for the corn oil, also a different opportunity in the animal feed because of the enhanced protein coming from sorghum distillers, but largely similar. There's some small side benefits from the antioxidant value of sorghum. When we think about how that works through the ruminant metabolism, the same as it would work through people, you know, we see a big increase in food grade sorghum as well. But by and large, substitutable. I think as we focus on water throughout this area, we're going to see more and more prevalence of sorghum in the ethanol and feed space for that matter. And it really just fits the system, right? Whether we're rotating with cotton in the south or wheat and corn here in Kansas, it's the ability to pull the levers that make the most sense on the farm and still support the value-added agriculture that's critical to our way of life.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
24 was a, there is no normal year. 24 was very, very far from normal.
Dr. Tyson Raper is University of Tennessee cotton and small grain specialist on the 2024 cotton growing season in Tennessee.
We had a lot of water early, and then it got fairly dry for us late, and we had some challenges there. With that said, you know, we still had productive crop. Price has been a challenge, and it looks like it will be a challenge for us in 25. But with that said, most of our cotton growers were pleased with what they were able to harvest out of the 24 season.
But with all the challenges, is there any optimism moving forward?
You know, if I were to paint like the worst possible scenario for trying to grow cotton, 24 was kind of that. A lot of water early that prevented taproot growth, and then we had very dry conditions late that, you know, I thought were going to really restrict yield. And as a state, the numbers are still pending, but I think we're going to be very close to, if not break, 1,000 pounds per acre, which is just absolutely incredible. I think we've reached with the new germplasm really a new plateau. I think we're trying to figure out what that low could potentially be. But over 1,000 pounds for the year we had in 24 is incredible. And that commodity, you know, continues to deliver for us. You know, we've got concerns on price, but it's nice to know that even in challenging conditions, we could get to that type of a yield level.
2024 might have been a challenge, but looking back over 30 years, Dr. Dave Albers, a retired cotton development manager with Delta Pine.
To me, one of the real challenges, even though there was some positives that came out of it, but one of the real challenges was introduction of transgenic varieties. You know, we learned so much in those early days of Bolgard 1 and Roundup Ready 1 on you know, what's the right management. What is the right level of expectation from those new technologies? You know, Monsanto had these great new technologies like Bolgard and, of course, Roundup Ready 1 that brought great value to growers. But, you know, there were some constraints there. And I think, you know, working our way through some of those issues and those constraints, you know, there were a lot of positives, but a lot of challenges. So, I mean, you know, I guess that would be one of the more challenging or maybe one of the tougher times in the industry from the seed company and technology provider perspective.
Though retired now, remains optimistic.
Yeah, I've made this comment before, but I think, you know, if there was something that would have kept me, you know, from retiring, it would have been just what I see in the new technology in our breeding group and all the new tools that our breeding group has. I mean, we've had some great yield increases and great yield steps that we've been able to make in recent years with products like 1646 and, you know, great quality and fiber quality and yield, and our Classic 21 and 23 products, some really nice yield steps there. But what I see in our breeders' toolbox is more tools and the ability, I think, to bring those yield steps and with fiber, with all the right agronomics, at a quicker pace. So I think that's really, you know, the thing that really excites me is what's in the future. Yeah, we've got new traits coming, you know, Bolgard 4, HT4, those new things that are in the pipeline, Thrive On, brand new, and, you know, bringing value in a number of situations. But just being able to continue to breed and bring, you know, the genetic gain and yield quality and all the right agronomics, a lot of exciting things, a lot of good young, well, not good, excellent, young scientists coming into the marketplace, coming into to companies like Bayer to be able to bring new products to market. So to me, that's great news for the industry.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We are in an energy crisis in our country, and the first place is actually related to electricity.
At a Senate Energy and Natural Resources confirmation hearing Thursday, Interior Secretary nominee, former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum.
Electricity is at the brink. Our grid is at a point where it could go completely unstable. We could be just months away from having skyrocketing prices for Americans. And of course, as we talked about in the AI arms race, we need electricity for manufacturing. And AI is manufacturing intelligence. And if we don't manufacture more intelligence than our adversaries, it affects every job, every company, and every industry. You understand this, and we've got to get to work. The permitting right now in some of the queues in FERC for electricity, it's 7 years or longer. That queue in FERC is 95% intermittent sources and only 5% baseload. We need baseload to be able to allow the renewables to be part of the system. We've got to have the balance between those two, or the grid, which is like a giant machine, just doesn't work. And so we've got to get to work. And permitting reform and speeding permitting. Right now, we've stacked the deck where we are creating roadblocks for people that want to do baseload, and we've got massive tax incentives for people that want to do intermittent and unreliable. When the balance is out of whack, and we've got to bring it back in line, and we can do that and still achieve the objectives that we want to have about having cleaner environment, because the U.S. has done that. We are the one nation on the planet that's actually reduced CO2 over the last 20 years. We're the ones that have done it. China's doubled their CO2 emissions in the same time frame.
Building on energy, former governor and North Dakota Senator John Hoeven.
In addition to serving as Secretary Secretary of Interior, there's also the role as the leader of the National Energy Council, very important. Talk about how you implement a game plan to achieve that goal of energy dominance that President Trump wants for this nation.
Don't want to get caught in making forward-looking statements because the council will be formed by an EO, but I think that the intention, as you can read in President Trump's public statements, are he's very simple. He wants to cut red tape. He wants to have more affordable energy for us. He wants to sell energy to our friends and allies so they don't have to buy it from our adversaries. That's how we reduce tensions in the world. And then we've got to make sure that we're doing it in a smart way because he talks all the time about clean air, clean water. So he basically talking about the approach that we're talking about here at this committee. This committee will be deeply involved in helping set those policies, but it's an all of above, go get it done, and stop getting in the way of ourselves. And particularly with this AI, the AI battle, people don't understand that what's coming right now with AI revolution is going to happen during President Trump's term, where when we have generalized intelligence that we can manufacture, it's going to affect our ability to compete with every other power. And China they permitted more than 2 coal plants a week in the first half of 2023. And this is, they're already the world's largest emitter. So we're competing against someone who's going to create more electricity, produce more AI, and this could be how we lose the Cold War with them if we don't get it out. We have to do it here. And we're a country that believes in reclamation. We believe in following labor laws. China, child labor, no reclamation, no care about the environment. They're a tough competitor right now in terms of their ability to produce electricity. So we've got to get going. We've got to cut red tape. And we've got to realize that if you shut down U.S. energy production here, it doesn't help the global environment. That's a false trade-off. It doesn't help because somebody else produces it someplace else, less cleaner than we do.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, we're really fortunate to have a really engaged group of producer leaders at the boards at the national and the state level that really helped us communicate to USDA that this was important, that we weren't overlooked in this practice.
Matt Durler with National Sorghum Producers on how sorghum joined corn and soybeans in a new USDA rule on biofuels.
We had leadership at USDA open-minded to looking into the role sorghum could play and the rotations we have out here in the high plains of Kansas, Texas, and Oklahoma, and open-minded to looking at how much ethanol was already coming from sorghum and the role it needed to play. So we put all hands on deck, getting to D.C. when we needed to, participating in the meetings, sharing data. You know, we have a really good staff that's accumulated a lot of data over time that's helped inform the markets where we can, but been as engaged as we possibly could be for the last 9 months. So really happy to see that we were included in the rulemaking.
What is 45Z?
So 45Z, the Clean Fuels Production Credit, was written into law as part of the Inflation Reduction Act. And essentially, that monetizes tax credits for ethanol plants that can reduce their carbon intensity below 50 grams per megajoule, and each point being worth 2 cents a point. So that may sound like a bunch of academic numbers to start with, but when we get to the point where rubber meets the road, it's rewarding ethanol plants for being more efficient in their fossil fuel usage and production. You know, there's a lot of opportunities for technology developments in the ethanol plant. But then with the rulemaking we got yesterday in the interim final rule from USDA, it draws the connection to the farm level practices and the role that farm practices play in ethanol production. When we think about the carbon intensity of ethanol, about half of that carbon intensity comes from the farm gate. And the way we manage the farm has a tremendous impact on the overall score of those fuels. So with the rules we have yesterday and taking into account the county by county differences, there's an opportunity for farmers to be rewarded for their resilient farm practices. You know, there's more to this than just carbon. These rotations that fit a system are an important piece. The water conservation is an important piece. So why the metrics are built around carbon, this is a building block towards demonstrating how resilient agriculture works and keeping incentives in place that incentivize ingenuity and efficiency. You know, the innovation amongst the American farmers is really good. And with the right incentive structure, we keep pushing farther. And it allows us to tell a really compelling story of how we have the most efficient food, fuel, and fiber system anywhere in the world, really.
It is, however, an interim rule.
45Z is a tax credit that's supposed to be in place for 25, 26, and 27. Well, obviously, we're well into 2025 at this point and don't have finalized rulemaking. So a program that was going to start January 1st is still getting the kinks ironed out in it. And so the time is of the essence in the current structure. The interim rulemaking we got yesterday has a 60-day comment period at USDA. And after that period, the Treasury then will decide what aspects or all of the rule it may adopt into final 45Z rulemaking. This, coupled with the green model coming out of Argonne National Labs, will paint the whole picture in the rules for engagement here. So I can't overemphasize enough that this is an interim rule. It still needs political support to make it to the final draft from the IRS. And there's a lot of uncertainty around this at this point. So we're committed to working with the current staff and commend the efforts to get this far in the rule, but also the incoming staff at USDA to make sure this is pragmatic and something that can work at the farm gate, but also show the support for how important it is to have the farm practice tied into biofuels production. So the next 60 days are really critical in this comment period to see how this moves forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm proud to say that the 2017 TCJA, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, was a reflection and a result of several years of thoughtful exchange and really diving deep into what we could do at the time to grow our economy, create more opportunity, create more fairness in the tax code, I might add.
Nebraska Representative Adrian Smith is a member of the House Ways and Means Committee on the foundation of the tax cuts.
I think one thing that is left out of the discussion today, especially as we heard some testimony earlier, is that even Barack Obama, when he was president, realized that we needed to be more competitive on the corporate side and proposed a reduction in the rate. Now, a different rate than we ended up at, but Barack Obama, hardly even a moderate president, suggested we needed to be more competitive. He saw the inversions that were taking place over and over and over again that I don't think a score has ever truly reflected the damaging aspects of an uncompetitive corporate tax rate. Now, we can talk about this all we want and characterize this in different ways. But fact of the matter is, we were in a bad spot as a country before TCJA. And yes, had we only done corporate, that would not have been a good look. And as we hear here today, again, the impacts of what we did for families was very positive. Without going so far as President Biden did with pushing more money, so much money out there, calling it tax relief, but it was just pushing money out there that triggered inflation. So I think it is incredibly important, and I believe we owe the American people a discussion, an exchange, in sharing ideas and reflecting on reality that we would shape policy moving forward in a productive fashion. And when I say productive, I mean with this process, but Ms. Silver very accurately, I believe, and appropriately described, and we sought out in 2017 on productivity for manufacturers such as Ms. Silver. Now, I think it was important that we were agnostic on size of a company so that everyone could benefit. But we knew that with increased productivity, if a business would see advantages in the tax code to adding new equipment, as Ms. Silver articulated, that the end result would be good for the company on a micro basis, but great for the economy as a whole as more U.S. companies became more productive and more profitable. Now, call me unreasonable, but I think profitability is a good thing. Profitability around this town is demonized. So often, I think it's sad. And we owe the American people a better discussion than what we've been seeing way too often here. But I just think it's important to note that the thoughtfulness that went into 2017, I think there's a greater understanding these days that what we did in 2017 was the right thing to do, especially given the factors to consider at the time. And now looking backward, I'm proud to say we did the right thing. Now, we want to prepare for the future. What do we need to do to be more competitive moving forward? Let's look at that. But let's not ignore the successes that we had.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Technical guidelines for climate-smart agriculture crops used as biofuel feedstocks. That is the subject of an interim rule published Wednesday by the Agriculture Department. Secretary Tom Vilsack visited with reporters about the interim rule.
These standards could be adopted by clean transportation fuel programs to incentivize the production of biofuel feedstock crops using climate-smart practices. If leveraged in clean transportation fuel programs, these standards may help farm producers earn a price premium for reduced carbon intensity biofuel feedstocks, facilitating both climate benefits and new market opportunities.
A 60-day public comment period on the interim rule is now underway, with comments accepted online at regulations.gov. In addition, USDA is publishing a beta version of its feedstock carbon intensity calculator as a method to obtain farm-scale carbon intensity scores within the standards of the interim rule. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.